This is Andrew McFadgen Ketchum with poemoftheweek.org. The following tells the story of the death of young poet Joshua Van Zandt and his professor's efforts to publish his work. In 2010, Ropewalk Press published Max, a dark, surreal chapbook of poems by late young poet Joshua Van Zandt. A graduate of the MFA program at Southern Illinois University Carbondale in 2005, Van Zandt took his own life on July 20th, 2007. He left behind his wife, Jen Talbot, their two children, Avery and Silas, and a significant body of work that Van Zandt's professor and mentor at SIUC, award-winning poet and Professor Rodney Jones, felt compelled to bring to a larger audience.
I was with Josh primarily for 3 years when he lived here in Carbondale, and I corresponded with him after that sporadically. He lacked confidence. He never had enough confidence. He was very hard on his own poems. He was one of those students who really I didn't criticize as much as I encouraged him because he was tremendously hard on himself. Josh came in with a gift for telling a story, desire to write, I believe, surreal poetry of a sort. And while he was here, he discovered his own unique way of doing things, I think. His gift was expressive. His desire in his poems was usually to be more minimal.
After Van Zandt graduated from the program, he wrote Jones a number of times. In these letters, he talked about his plans to finish his book, Max and the Life of Big Machines, and send it to the first book contests. These letters also chronicled bouts of serious drinking, his difficulties getting work as a carpenter, as well as problems with his family. Mind you, Jones says, this is all put lightly, as Josh always put everything. When Jones learned of Van Zandt's death more than a year later, he contacted Talbot to express his desire to put together a collection of Van Zandt's work.
Joshua had a unique expressive gift. He had a unique concern for the reader of his work. He does not linger or ever become indulgent with his work. It is very unusual in my experience of poetry. And I wanted to gather his work after he had died. I consulted with Jen, his wife, and she sent me all of these materials from computers. Sometimes the files were almost corrupt.
Merging these files with Van Zandt's graduate thesis, Jones approached Ron Mitchell, co-founder and editor of Ropewalk Press, with 42 pages of manuscript.
Ron Mitchell and I were able to piece together a semblance of what he had intended. He was thinking of this as a manuscript, which would be a larger book, and there are poems that we have not printed, some of them very good.
The last touch was retitling the manuscript to Max, a nod to Van Zandt's minimalist approach and to the persona he created for himself in the collection. The result is an ominous book of poems. Permeated with psychological pain and dysfunction, Max is as stark a volume as is its subject matter, and it's clear from page one that Max is a sluggish, infinitely sad persona of Van Zandt himself, navigating this strange landscape in which, quoting from the Teenage Death Cantata, the dangerous autumn blooms open with large machines, and the cheerleaders kick death to death. Shaped less by narrative than by the cryptic circling images and characters of the underworld Max is charged with surviving, Max reads like an elegy to the once idyllic American Midwest where Van Zandt was raised and where his doppelganger wanders. Max is haunted by apparitions of his ancestors and other similarly mysterious characters, like the girl with X's for eyes, the Green Knight, and the moon, who in landscape passes judgment from behind his big, dark desk. Almost everything is malevolently personified in Max's world. The Green Knight feeds on blood, corn, headlights, and paranoia. Satellites chirp away in digital cadence. The sun, at one point, tells Max to kill himself. The big machines drop from the title figure largely in the book as symbols of the silos, trains, and combines that have allowed for the transition of the American plains into the producer of nearly a quarter of the world's food supply. And, perhaps as a result, into the culture of machismo and self-destruction among many of the men who make it run. Cornfields and death are synonymous in these poems. Cornscape read here by poet Matthew Graham, is one such example.
Hornscape. Max holds the bones of a small child in his mouth. Rattle, rattle, rattle him to sleep. The bare white room. The grain bins lean in to listen from the green night of dark corn. The sunrise comes on like a pink and purple barroom neon, as if the moon ever really mattered. Max lays down his toolbox heart.
One particularly compelling element of the collection is that a majority of the poems are in a strange form of omniscient first person.
Max was an alter ego, though it's very difficult to say which of those people, Josh or Max, was more real to him. Max is a figment of his vision of himself. I think it was a freeing device, Max, but I think it was one of those things that works like a mask that allows one to be more fully and vibrantly a self in the world. I didn't understand the completeness of his immersion in that idea. I don't think he chose Max accidentally.
Clonopin Max, the penultimate poem of the collection, is read here by Jones.
When you were finally sedated, Max, the days were like butterflies impaled on barbed wire fences. And they were beautiful, and they were not beautiful, in their fluttering screams from the hedgerows. Much like you, Max. And aren't you tired of my voice and the burned-down history I tell? Blame it on October, the skeleton trees. Blame it on the children and their masks wandering the old sidewalks endlessly. Ah, Max, tell them to stop their hunting. Is that how you want your son, drunk daddy, in the green night where there will be no blossoming? Blame the moon. Blame the sun.
When Max is finally given the opportunity to speak, it's via a sequence of telegrams, a form in which Max's self-expression is keyed down to its barest parts and at all times demands silence.
This is telegram number 3. Leslie Ann, I am tired. Stop. There is a large black slug in my heart. Stop. I must stop thinking like this. Stop. This house of ours, this house of brutal architecture, where my drunk daddy walks the hallways. Stop. I believe Leslie Ann is the persona that is the female equivalent of Max. She's probably made out of the real person that he loved, Jen. There's a moment when a person is out there on a drug or alcohol and alone late at night and seeking a friend. Often these telegrams are from that person, I believe.
Ending with a lengthy, sectionalized poem, Epilogue, Max and the Life of Big Machines, the fifth and final section describes a photograph of one of Vinzant's ancestors, who brought his family to the American Midwest that was once fruitful, but is now a soul-consuming wasteland. Your DNA in his sweat, Max. See him there, standing in the hand-hewn barn, the skinny man, mourning the gray stillborn son, the laughing daughter, to tetanus, beside the slow brown river, under the ridge line blue, under the sun, where we fold our bodies into the faceless, unforgiving earth. No doubt, many will read Max as a lengthy suicide note. On April 12, 2007, 3 months prior to his suicide, Vinzant posted Max on Tuesday on his blog entitled In the Pirate Corn, which he had only just started in order to chronicle the writing of his manuscript. The poem opens, "The sun once said, Max, commit suicide. It spun once on its thin silver tether, stood up and winked, then died." Likewise, one of the few poems published in the collection, Max Gives a Poetry Reading, read here by Robert Wrigley, paints death in an unusually bittersweet light.
Max Gives a Poetry Reading. I was reading this poem down at the local old folks' home about how death comes surely and painfully to us all, when I felt the strong desire to tell them my taking a shit on acid story and my friend Moon who snorted the biggest mound of meth I've ever seen a guy snort story. and I questioned this desire. All the while, still reading my poem about how death comes surely and painfully to us all, where I go on in the poem to say how death is just the fucking ace of spades, no delusional heaven of harps and white, and that even as the heart stops or the brain takes the oh my God snap of a tired aneurysm, there are some seconds there where we unfurl like white sheets on a summer clothesline, wind holding us aloft before our gods. I could tell by some looks that the farm wives in the audience really got what I meant. I listened to the orchestra of oxygen tanks and thought of Moon conjuring his own grace from a Les Paul's low E, and how he played that guitar like he was killing snakes. This took me back to my strong desire and to thinking of my getting laid in a hayloft on Saturday night while smoking pot and drinking whiskey, one of the greatest nights of my life, and she couldn't have been more lovely, high or sober story. I saw a man staring off into the institutional peach space behind me and remembered Leslie Ann in the moonlight, a gravel road. I probably wouldn't do anything different about that night, even if I had the chance. And all my best stories involve a going up and a coming down. I made a decision. I worked it into the poem about Leslie Ann and the gravel road and even the moonlight, just one line. And I was pleased to see how well it went over after all that business about unfurling and being held before a god.
But this is poetry, not autobiography. And as Jones is fond of reminding his students, the myth that contemporary American poetry is based on fact is just that, myth. None of Vinzant's friends, family, or colleagues saw his suicide coming. True, Vinzant was a known alcoholic who struggled with a difficult past, but he was also known for his sense of humor and for his dedication to family. Talbot's best memories of Vinzant are of simple domestic life, making dinner together and talking on the deck after their children, Avery and Silas, their newborn, had been put to bed. He and Avery enjoyed hiking together and often built things in the garage. On one particular occasion, a rocket they constructed ended up on the neighbor's roof. Vinzant was particularly fond of teaching Silas how to care for the numerous plants he kept around their apartment. He loved fishing and often threw parties for his colleagues in the MFA program. While his work explored dark places, they were almost always redemptive. I was shocked to learn about Josh's death, says Chad Parmenter, a friend and colleague of Vinzant's at SIUC. It didn't resonate with anything that I knew of him. Jones agrees.
He loved to fish, and for a brief period I loaned him my boat, which came back with a motor that wasn't quite what it was before he borrowed it. But he was wonderful at being a Missouri boy, and a Missouri country boy, and I was an Alabama country boy, so I think we shared that love of the outdoors, of going out to fish and being simple.
While Jones was aware of Vinzant's postgraduate school life was a struggle, this was nothing unusual, and he was encouraged that Vinzant was continuing to work on his manuscript. But there was much that Jones and Vinzant's colleagues and friends didn't know. Living in his hometown of Maryville, Missouri, Talbot was teaching English at Northwest Missouri State University, while Vinzant was struggling to turn a profit as a home contractor. Josh, says Talbot, thought it would be good to be around his family, but it's thick with alcoholism, methamphetamine, religion gone sour, and the delusion and denial that come with them. Self-destructive behavior, she goes on, was practically mandated. Within just a few months of moving back home, Vinzant's father was committed to a nursing home due to alcohol-induced brain damage. His father, a mere 60 years of age, Vinzant feared this was to be his fate as well. So he checked himself into rehab and made some early, brief strides toward recovery in late 2006. But he started drinking again when the antidepressants he was prescribed made it all but impossible for Vinzant to function. By Christmas, Vinzant was drinking whiskey at 9 a.m. and spent many evenings with his family at the American Legion. In late January 2007, he received a DUI and lost his license. Running his business became all but impossible, and Vinzant fell deeper into depression. That June, Talbot and Vinzant's landlady sold the house they were renting, and they had to be out by July. Unfortunately, they just signed a lease in Indiana, where Talbot was slated to attend the PhD program at Purdue, but they couldn't move in until August. With Vinzant unable to leave the state of Missouri until his sentencing in July, Talbot was forced to move the family in with her parents in Illinois earlier that month, leaving Vinzant on his own. When he received his sentencing of 30 days in jail and probation on Tuesday, July 17, he was living in the country with his mother and stepfather. He sounded upbeat, says Talbot, when he spoke with her on the phone that Thursday, giving her a pep talk about her upcoming teaching assignments and making plans to move to Indiana in October. The next day, he was dead. Vinzant, like many who commit suicide, seems to have felt he was doing more harm than good to his family and to himself. It also seems that the poetry he was writing was less an act of escape than a harsh, unforgiving mirror of self-declared failings. It would be a mistake to read Max as anything but an accomplished work of art. Max should not be read as an artifact of a poet's mental illness and resulting desire to die, but as a body of poetry assembled by a community of those who knew and cared for Vinzant with the goal of sharing his vision with the world. But Max isn't the only thing Vinzant left behind, Talbot tells us. A month or so after he died, she was sorting through some of their belongings and found Silas's baby book. She hadn't written anything in it, the curse of the second baby, she says. But Vinzant had gone through and written about their lives, her pregnancy, Silas's birth, and how much he loved them. I have no idea when he did that, she says. Nor do I know if he did it because he knew, but I'm grateful for it. This has been a production of poemoftheweek.org. You can purchase Max, a chapbook of poems by Joshua Vinzant, at the Ropewalk Press website, www.usi.edu/ropewalk_press.asp. I would like to thank Joshua Vinzant, Jen Talbot, Rodney Jones, Ron Mitchell, Chad Parmenter, Barb Eidlin, Matt Garrison, Kevin McKelvey, Brett Griffiths, Robert Wrigley, and Matthew Graham for allowing me to use their content for this podcast. I would also like to thank WNIN Evansville for the use of Jessica Nadzayunas' interview with Rodney Jones. Finally, my thanks to Terrence Anderson, Technology and Learning at Pepperdine University, for his assistance in assembling this podcast.